As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnston. Lots to get to this weekend as the Raptors looking to continue to erase the memories of Game 1 in their series against the Indiana Pacers. Oh boy, the Stanley Cup playoffs are getting a whole lot of fun. And one of those teams with a tortured playoff history is through to the second round. Plus, some interesting stuff coming out of the world of MMA with Conor McGregor's non-retirement. Hey, and Tiger Woods is back in the news as well. But we start, gentlemen, with the Toronto Blue Jays, and there has not been a plethora of positive stories surrounding this team to start the season. The starting pitching has been good. That's nice. But now it's been mostly on-field problems for the Blue Jays so far this season. Now it moves off the field. And Chris Colabello is going to be off the field until late July, as he's been suspended 80 games for testing positive for an anabolic steroid. Apparently, it's a thing that was developed in East Germany, so not exactly new technology. But a guy that has had plenty written about him, plenty of features on Sportsnet about his incredible story, playing 7 years of independent ball, and a guy that seemed universally liked. It seems out of the blue. It seems out of nowhere. But certainly, for myself, being down at the ballpark, it was a different feeling surrounding this team with Chris Colabello having just addressed his team. It's just a weird and bizarre story.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems like he's a guy who, I mean, you could see the way John Gibbons was talking about him, Kevin Pillar. Obviously, this is a guy who has pretty strong bonds with some of the people on that team and is easy for fans to root for, but probably for the guys in the clubhouse as well, because, as you mentioned, Ben, the long and winding road he took to get here, then again, you start contemplating that long and winding road, and all of a sudden you start thinking, does this guy fit the profile of someone who might say, hey, I've been slugging it out here for a little while. Is there something I can do to help me take that final step? Because as is always the case with this, you know, if you're out there thinking I'm getting beat to the best jobs by people who may be shading the rules, the temptation then gets a lot greater to do the same yourself. So we don't know. All we know is that he, you know, as tends to be the case, vehemently denies knowingly taking it. Maybe that's true. We don't know. There's a lot of people who vehemently denied taking it who, it was later revealed, clearly knew exactly what they were doing. And it's hard not to be cynical about these things at this point in sports.
My question, the first thing that popped into my head was, so he hasn't been playing well at all this year.
Right.
So taking him out of the lineup in theory might not impact, you know, the rest of the team. He hasn't been producing yet, so maybe Smoke can come in and do just as well, if not better than him at the plate. But off of that, like you said, he's universally a well-liked guy. So if this affects the clubhouse in a negative way, that's my question is, he hasn't been doing great on the field, but so the impact might not be there. But what type of effect is this going to have on the clubhouse?
Well, and that's a larger sporting question, especially when you're talking about baseball, which seems like almost separate from the other team sports because it is such an individual game masquerading as a team sport. But back to what you said about his performance this year, and like we talked about. He knew he tested positive on March 13th, middle of spring training. He was informed by the Players Association that there was a positive test. And according to Kevin Pillar, because we haven't heard from Chris yet, he's just released a statement. But Kevin Pillar says he filed all the appeals. He defended himself. That's why we only found out in the middle of April, middle end of April, when he found out on March the 13th. I mean, I can't imagine that didn't affect his performance, because you talk about sure. the performance not being there for Chris Colabello, but imagine you got like the sword of Damocles hanging over your head for the first few weeks of the season. You got to figure that played into it as well. But you're right, there is this whole other aspect of things, and people like to infer that, hey, you got to be happy, you got to have guys that like each other in that clubhouse to win, which, I mean, history would tell us is not exactly true all the time, and usually it works the other way, where you win first and then you all like each other. It's hard not to like each other when you're stepping onto the field every day and winning. But you're right, he does seem like a guy that people like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing, you know, you liking one another and having good chemistry, it is important, but it isn't the be-all, end-all. You know, I've read things that, oh, this Jays team, it just isn't the same, and they bring it back to a guy like Munenori Kawasaki.
Yeah, like, let's take like it his, easy on that.
Exactly, but it's sort of the same element in the fact that it can affect team chemistry. At the end of the day, he wasn't playing well, whether that has to do with he was nervous, he was, you know, distracted, or maybe he was just...
off the juice.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he was just... No. See, I'm also one of these guys, and I'm completely naive, and I admit this. I like to trust in my fellow humans.
I don't.
So, really?
Yeah. I've been burned too many times. We're good,
but continue. Yeah.
So, we don't really know all the facts, other than he failed the drug test and
right.
He's been suspended.
And we also know the climate in which he lost or failed this drug test. Because, I don't know, point to the example in Major League Baseball where it's been proven a guy was unfairly painted with the brush as a cheater, as a performance enhancer user, and it was not true. I mean, you can point to Ryan Braun might have been a guy at first when his initial test was thrown out because of mishandling breaking a protocol.
Vehement denial, too, right? Like,
exactly.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, and he's, I mean, that's, there was nobody that protested more than him. And eventually, you know, we know the truth eventually came out. He did it. Lance Armstrong for decades.
Sure.
Right? Like, just, we've seen this before. It's hard. Maybe, you know, 10 years ago, Mike, I would have been, you know, with you in trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, because I it would be a fun place to live in.
That was young, naive Ben.
Yeah.
See,
I'm hardened now.
It's not just giving the guy the benefit of the – I'm not saying that he knowingly took it and he's just denying it, and I don't – and I hope the guy didn't knowingly take it. I'm thinking if you took something and you didn't know you were taking it – I know it's no excuse. You have to know what you're putting into your body, but you see this all the time.
I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a chemist, and I can only tell you like basically what I've read on Wikipedia about the thing. But it's not exactly something that they're throwing in your booster juice, right? Like this is something that's making, you know, East German women like grow mustaches
mm-hmm.
in the '80s.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing. It's been around so long, and people have known about this type of steroid. I'm not even going to try to pronounce it.
There's an unconfirmed report that they're going to reduce the suspension by 40 games if Colabello can actually spell the steroid.
Yeah. There's no chance of that. If he can even pronounce it.
No, exactly. But the fact that it is such a blatant, you know, drug failure, you know.
It does seem brazen, right? Like,
yeah.
And a guy who, and I mean, there's two ways I view it. One is, yeah, a guy hanging on to the fringes, a guy that spent 7 years in independent ball just trying to make it to the major leagues, try to get that paycheck, finally realize his dream. But the other is he made it.
Mm-hmm.
He did it. And maybe he did it on the strength of some performance enhancers a year ago. But would you risk it all? And
would you risk it all with something like this? See, that's what raises a red flag for me, is it's so obvious. If you take something with... You know, if you take a pill that's this and it's going to make you stronger, make you recover quicker, but you know this is definitely, you can't take this. You're going to get suspended if you take this. So that's why I'm thinking that it was an accident. Like maybe he just unknowingly took it.
You're so cute.
Oh, man. But, you know, I cover a lot of mixed martial arts, and I see a lot of drug tests, and I don't mean to bring this back to MMA.
Well,
but
it came naturally into your world as well with the name Frank Mir getting bandied about.
Yes, exactly. Kevin Pillari mentioned that, you know, Frank Mir a couple weeks ago or last month, he popped for the same substance that Chris Colabello just did, and he's facing a two-year suspension because, you know, they're suspensions in mixed martial arts in the UFC are handled differently than in Major League Baseball. But he, you know, he's gone his whole career, never failed a drug test. The UFC is in partnership with USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, and he passed multiple drug tests.
So did Lance Armstrong.
This year alone, though, and it's on record, you know, they test these guys very often. And so when he was flagged by USADA that he had failed, he had popped for this substance, he was, you know, shocked, as they all are. And so he's fighting it, and now it looks like Colabello and might try to join forces with Frank Mir to see, like, what could we have potentially taken? Because they do genuinely seem surprised about it, you know, just to figure this out. If it was a mistake, if it was I was handed the wrong thing or I made a mistake, if they work together, we might actually be able to find a definitive answer. But it's interesting, like Frank Mir is also one of these athletes that fits the mold of an older athlete.
Right.
He's an, you know, no disrespect intended, but he's an over-the-hill athlete. He's past his prime, and he's hanging on. He's trying to still compete with the best, just like Chris Colabello
absolutely.
Will be. So, you know, they fit the mold in the same, in a lot of ways, you know, different sports. But it is interesting that a lot of these athletes, you take products, and maybe this product doesn't apply to that, but failing a drug test in general, a lot of these things that are considered banned substances, they're not illegal steroids. I think that a lot of people still, when you throw the word steroids out there, you think of bodybuilders and needles and you know, that kind of thing. But there's a lot of different types of steroids. There's a lot of different, you know, topical creams and pills that they're not illegal. You can go and you can buy them.
So now you're on team steroid now?
I'm not on team steroid, although Barry Bonds is a Hall of Famer.
Yes, sure.
But, you know, I think sometimes it is just an innocent mistake.
Sure.
And maybe it is the, you know, I only see the silver lining in me. I just think that a lot of athletes in general don't mean to take the substances.
It's 2016. Like, we've seen so many of these cases. Like, how dumb can you be? And Kevin Pillar said, hey, Chris Colabello won't even let anyone put protein in his smoothies. Like, he does it all himself. He brings his own stuff on the road. I mean, these guys are well aware that if you take something, whether it's knowingly or unknowingly, you're painted with the same paintbrush. They're extremely careful. It's just hard for me. But that's a separate issue. I think we should move on from whether he did it or not, because we don't have any of the evidence either. It's very early days in this, and whether we'll ever find out really, I guess is a question. So what do the Blue Jays do at first base? Justin Smoke is, according to John Gibbons, the everyday first baseman for now. I think we have a pretty good sense of what he is. He's a big swing guy. Sometimes he misses, sometimes he makes contact. Hasn't hit one over the wall yet this year. He's taken the occasional walk, and his defense is pretty good as well. Is that a guy you can afford to run out there 162 times during the regular season?
I think at this point, he's, you know, in the short term, it's automatic. He's in there. You don't really have another option for the moment. But, you know, you mentioned off air, they have the guy in AAA, Montero.
Yeah, Jesus Montero.
Jesus Montero, they can call him up. If Smoke comes in, and the fact that he gets more playing time just is better for him. You know, some guys like playing every day. Some guys perform better when they're in the lineup every day, as opposed to, you know, they don't know how often they're going to play. I think this, you just, for the next handful of games or few weeks, you see how he does, And if he struggles, if he puts up similar numbers to the poor numbers that Colabella was putting up, then you do something because the, you know, you can't, you're not going to win when guys in your lineup are hitting that poorly.
How long do you think the Blue Jays rope is for being eh?
Well, that's the thing. And it would be a lot easier if everybody else was hitting. And you know what? Okay, so Josh Donaldson, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion pretty much have been steady offensive influences since the start of the season. Michael Saunders was too before he went down with his hamstring injury. Who knows? But this team is searching for offense right now. I don't know if they can continue to ride another 2 weeks of Justin Smoke being meh if there's a potential better option out there. Not that Jesus Montero is 100% a better option, but he's a guy who had a strong prospect pedigree and was viewed as a real offensive force when the Yankees traded him to Seattle for Michael Pineda. That was viewed as a great baseball move. Of course, it didn't work out for Montero, and maybe there was conditioning issues there as well, but apparently has slimmed down. There's him. I mean, there's other different permutations with guys who you can throw in different positions, move guys to first base, move guys into the DH spot, have Edwin Encarnacion play first base. There are things you can do. And I know the refrain is it's early. And you know what? It is. It's still early. But at a certain point, it is no longer early. I mean, when we get late May into June, certainly it won't be early. And even, you know, once April's done here, that's a significant sample size of at-bats for everybody. Not that you know exactly what everybody is offensively, but yeah, I think you're right, Ryan, that there is a point where it's no longer tenable, the offensive production they've gotten out of first base.
Well, and I think just in general, too, the bigger question becomes, I mean, we became so accustomed last year to seeing this team just thump teams and put the squeeze on every starting pitcher. And I think the Blue Jays, rightfully so, bought themselves a lot of benefit of the doubt to start this year. That coupled with, as you mentioned, it's a really long season, means no one should be jumping to big conclusions. But I guess I'm curious, too, to know what you guys think. Even under best case scenario or good case scenario, how good do you think the lineup is outside 2, 3, 4, and I guess 5? I mean, I know that's a good stretch, but outside those, that hole, what do you realistically think the Blue Jays are? And of course, the implicit question there is, are they too reliant on those four guys?
Well, so I actually have a stat.
Ooh!
I have a stat. Yeah,
facts that's not accepted on this program.
And so it's not, I guess, it's not super impressive, but if you compare this team to last year's team, you know, just this powerhouse runs, leading the league in runs and everything, if the Jays this season, and maybe it's more of a commentary on the quality of pitching we've seen so far, but if the Jays batters, if they averaged the same amount of runs per game that they were averaging last year, they would be 15-3 right now.
Sure.
So that's my stat. How was that?
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, right?
Well, they on that road trip, they averaged 3.3 runs a game. And how about this stat?
Oh.
And I look back at the dead ball era, the lowest runs per game that in 1908 was the height of the dead ball era.
I was going to say, I don't even know when the dead ball era is. It's that long ago.
1908, okay. Teams averaged 3.4 runs per game, and the Blue Jays averaged 3.3 on this road trip. So yeah, it's not been great offensively for this Blue Jays team.
You also have to remember last year, again, different team, different circumstances, but at one point they were 50-51.
Yeah, right at the trade deadline, right, basically, right?
Now, this year, I don't know if they're going to be a team that is going to be in a position to make the blockbuster types of deals that they made last year.
Well, presumably not.
Exactly. But so if they're...
But they already have Troy Tulowitzki.
So theoretically, they should be better than they were at this point last year, which is kind of where they were at this point last year. So that's what's troubling.
In really basic terms, how long do you think, for whatever reasons, how long do you think they can be a 500 team before people are like, okay, what's going on here?
Well, I think you can go, because baseball is it's a game of hot streaks, right? Like, you've got, sometimes your pitching's hot, sometimes your offense is hot, and it's when those two things line up, you go on rolls.
Right.
And the best teams have consistent enough offenses and pitching that they line up a lot. Like the Chicago Cubs right now are going berserk because both things have been ridiculous to start the season. I mean, 50-51 is a long time when you're talking about 101 games to be hanging around 500. You'd prefer it to come along like maybe in May. And you know what? Maybe it comes together today. But back to your original point about maybe the rest of this offense outside of 2, 3, 4, 5. And I say five because we
have injuries and with Tulowitzki, right? I mean,
right. I mean, if it's one thing to talk about guys in long track records and eventually coming around and hitting like Troy Tulowitzki, it's not going to happen if they're not in the lineup.
Right.
And I know it's just one game with the hip issue and apparently not serious, although we've heard that refrain multiple times when referred
to. I didn't do
to,
it. I didn't mean to do it.
that, yeah, if he's not in the lineup every day and you do have to run Ryan Goins out there at shortstop, which means Darwin Barney's playing second base until Devin Travis returns. Like that's, and you don't have Michael Saunders, who was really hitting on all cylinders atop this lineup. It changes things. I do think Russell Martin is going to be the Russell Martin we saw, and we started to see some hard contact. And even before he left the game in the sixth inning against the A's on Friday, had a double, and he's a notorious slow starter. It was a very slow starter last year as well. And Troy Tulowitzki is going to be fine-ish. Although I do question whether he's like this super offensive juggernaut guy that we saw in Colorado. Certainly there's
always the Colorado question.
Right. But his road splits when he was a Rocky were good. But just not, you know, otherworldly. He's not Josh Donaldson, but I think you can imagine like more than league average production from him. But yeah, there are, I mean, is Kevin Pillar a guy that you can rely on for any level of offense?
Well, not as a leadoff hitter, but no. they've moved him out, and he, you know, his first game when they moved him back down the lineup, he had three hits or something. I think, you know, Gibby loves playing with his lineup and shifting guys around, and I think that once they maybe that's what they do for the next little while. They look at the batting order and they tweak things here and there, and then maybe something clicks. Maybe it just works one lineup. Or you even had the suggestion off air that if first base does become a problem, maybe you see what Batista, you know, you give him a break from the outfield. He's played first base throughout his career in the past, at least. And you know, you move him to first, and then you give another guy, Dalton Pompey or somebody, a chance in the outfield, and you make these little moves here and there until something clicks. And if something doesn't click, then you maybe make a big change. Maybe you pull the trigger on a trade in a month or two or something.
Yeah.
Until then, you just figure it out.
It's still too early, I think, for massive moves like what you're talking about. But yeah. First back and to get it back to first base and talking about comparing this year's offense to a season ago, a big part of what this team did offensively was first base last year, whether it was Chris Colabello or Justin Smoke. Those guys, you combine the two, they had over 30 home runs and they hit, you know, had a great on base percentage. If you're getting below league average production from first base, that is like it's a big hit to your offense, and it changes the offensive outlook. I mean, Josh Donaldson's an MVP. He's great. Jose Bautista is great. Edwin Encarnacion's great. We know those guys are great, but is this team going to score 900 runs again? Like, that was ridiculous. Maybe we did see something like once in a generation type of offensive production from a team.
Well, let's flip it around then, because it's obviously tied to the pitching as well. Would we agree that Friday night, notwithstanding the best story of the season for Toronto, has been the emergence of Sanchez looking like a real legit starter? Then you put that in the larger framework of the rotation. Hap's been good. It's kind of a question of how much will the pitching potentially regress versus how much do you see the offense going up, right? Like the rotation has been great, and I don't think anyone thinks it will be this good the whole way through, maybe, but it's probably due to come down a little. But you see any loss by the pitching, you do still kind of see more potential for gains on the offense, right?
I think there's no question about that.
If the pitching holds, then you're really
right. I mean, there's. Do I expect Jay Happ to have an ERA like under two?
Sure,
maybe.
But
not.
But Dickey's going to get better by the end.
Right.
You know, he'll have his normal. Oh well, since June 14th, he's actually, you know, 10th and top 10 in all these categories, kind
right.
of thing.
And it seems like Marcus Stroman is a guy you can rely on.
Absolutely, because you forget that was more of a question mark based on. You know, 2014, he was, I think, here half the year. 2015, he missed most of the year. So now he's starting 2016 as your ace. He still doesn't have a lot of experience on his resume, and he's been fantastic so far. So that doesn't necessarily feel like a huge win because everyone did kind of expect it, but still, it could have gone another way.
Plus, there's the concept that nobody's exactly, and I know the Orioles are off to a nice start. They were a team that was expected to be fourth or fifth in the division preseason rankings. And I don't know how much I'm coming off that, considering their starters have thrown the fewest innings in all of baseball. The offense is good. We knew that. They were going to strike out a ton but hit some home runs. Nobody's really gone berserk. Like the Red Sox, with their offseason acquisition of David Price, he's been very lackluster. Was handed a five-run lead or a four-run lead against the Rays. And they lost a heartbreaker. Like, there's...
Even Kimbrel has not been lights out for them thus far, anyways.
Yeah, the Blue Jays have gotten to him, albeit it was in an eighth inning. He's looked spectacular at times. And the Yankees have a spectacular back end of the bullpen, but they're below 500 as well. It's not like anybody is off to, you know, a 15-2 start to the season.
No, and no one's running away with this division, right? Everyone has warts, and it's very... easy to still make the case that top to bottom, the Blue Jays have the best team.
And you mentioned earlier, like, how long can the Jays go along chugging along at around 500? And that really depends on what I think the answer is it depends on what the rest of the division does. Mm-hmm. You know, because last year we saw they went into game 100 and they were still at or below 500. But the division was... It was a relatively weak division last year.
Like, yeah, but they were 8 games back, though, as well, right? Like, the Yankees weren't spectacular, but they were...
They did have
that was
lead.
A massive lead.
Yeah, you forget they just eviscerated that Yankee lead.
But I think it will come down to, you know, if one team in the division starts pulling away, it'll look, you know, being 2 games below 500 or hovering around 500 looks a lot worse when you have a double-digit, you know, lead games to... To catch up.
Well, and it seems like the offense really couldn't be any worse. Like, you look at the hitting with runners in scoring position, 2-for-12 in that game against the Orioles. I think they were 0-for-8 in the final game of the series. Like, it's hard to imagine this offense being any worse. And if it just clicks one day, like we're all expecting it to, or everybody's just kind of waiting for it to do, you win the last 2 games against the A's, you're back at 500. Things are hunky-dory once again. Like, if Troy Tulowitzki's back in the lineup, Michael Saunders returns, and the pitching's the same deal. I mean, it's early enough in the season, and the hole's not that deep enough that, like, it's going to just take one big hit from this team to break out.
Yeah, a lot of Jays fans, I guess sports fans in general, the knee-jerk reactions, they're huge fans of that. I saw even some talk recently on Twitter that people are calling for Gibby's head, and it's just, you know, it's too early in the season for that. Like, yes, they have to play better, but it's not full-blown panic mode right yet. Right now it can't be.
Well, if you lose Troy Tulowitzki for an extended period of time, I think it might be. And certainly if you lost Russell Martin for any period of time, because that looked like it might be a scary scenario when he left the game on Friday, though apparently just neck spasms, might even play in the game on Saturday. That's a guy they can't afford to lose. Raptors win. All the hand-wringing that took place after their Game 1 loss of the Air Canada Centre to the Pacers, kind of in our rearview mirror after 2 straight wins, the most recent on the road in Indy, and the most complete performance of the postseason so far for the Raptors, reminiscent of the team that won 56 games during the regular season. We'll talk about that series coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. It's Ryan Dixon. It's Mike Johnson. I'm Ben Ennis. On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Arden Zwelling.
Everybody talks about the 5 tools in baseball, but in Josh Donaldson's opinion, there's a 6th, health. In his mind, if you have 5 tools but aren't able to take the field every day and use them, what does it even matter? It's a good point. Injuries in baseball are not uncommon. The MLB season demands teams play 162 games in 184 days, in an era when the game is played more intensely than ever before. Pitchers are throwing harder, balls are coming off bats faster, some people are going to get hurt. It's an incredibly intense game, and nobody embodies that intensity quite like Donaldson. Yet, he hasn't been on the disabled list in years. He's played 158 games each of the last three seasons, and the way he plays, going all out, all the time, makes that an extremely difficult thing to do. It's a primary reason why Donaldson is the reigning MVP. How does he do it? Find out in Sportsnet Magazine's MLB Preview.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet Magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet Magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones.
All seven and we'll watch them fall. They stand in the way of love and we will smoke them all with an intellect.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Mike Johnson and Ryan Dixon. Raptors lost game one of the Pacers in kind of brutal, heartbreaking fashion and what some might call a choke job. And maybe the moment too big for the Raptors. Since then, though, big time bounce back. Won game two at the Air Canada Center. Won game three going away from the Pacers in Indiana, 101-85. And, gents, after DeMar DeRozan was nowhere to be seen for the first two games, bounced back as well in game three, 21 points, although the shooting percentage not great, 7 of 19. But in game two, he didn't get to the line at all, was 0 for 0. And in game three, 7 of 9 from the stripe, more like the DeMar DeRozan we're used to seeing. Where is this team right now, as far as the feelings after game one and now up 2-1 in the series?
Yeah, I think they're miles from, well, the team itself, maybe they were just putting on a brave face. I don't know. But I think their faith in themselves wasn't really shaken. It was obviously disheartening for all the fragile Raptors fans to see them lose game one at home. And I have to believe it did rattle them a bit, because all of a sudden you're in a situation where you can't lose game two. That's it. Like, yeah, you're instantly in a spot, which is kind of what's fantastic about sports, where they had to win that game. They did. And then they go on the road. And I would say game three was basically a perfect game for the Raptors. So, I mean, given that DeRozan, you know, had that good showing, had 21 points, I think they're in a really good spot. And I don't want to get carried away, but I mean, I know this is the sort of unquantifiable thing, but you just really had that sense that this team just had to get its feet under it and it could really take off. And I do wonder if now they'll really get into a nice stride.
It almost seems like they just had to get out of Toronto for a bit, because you're right. You could feel it in that crowd. And yes, the players didn't exactly look all that comfortable with a tight game late in a playoff game on home court. But I think there is something to, hey, they can feel the tension in the crowd. And you just...
No doubt.
You can remember watching the Red Sox in the playoffs pre-2004, and you just felt like the sense of doom surrounding that team, that something bad was about to happen, because it had year after year after year. It feels like Mike, this team just needs to get over that hump and everybody can just exhale, and then it's, oh, we're just one of 30 teams or one of 16, or I guess it would just be 8 at that point in the playoffs.
Yeah, late in game one, when it was, you know, it was close, the Pacers would make a shot and the Air Canada Center would just kind of go quiet. Like, that's not what you... And it's because, the Raptors fan base, they've been kind of on edge all year. Like, this is the best Raptors team ever, best regular season ever, and yet there's still that nervous energy among the fan base because of the recent struggles, all the struggles, not recent, just throughout the franchise, all the losses, all the collapses the last couple years. I mean, it's only been a couple games since game one, but man, the momentum, it just seems, it's completely shifted. It looks at this point like Paul George isn't going to take over the series. Like, to me, he was the one player on the Pacers that can really, it's tough for the Raptors to match up with. He's tough for most teams to match up with. And like last game, he didn't take over the game. He was great the first two games, but his teammates aren't shooting the ball well. The Pacers are only shooting 41%. They're getting out-rebounded like crazy. That's, to me, if you're a Raptors fan, you're more excited about the improvement in Jonas Valanciunas than you are in the, you know, relative struggles of DeRozan and Lowry, because their offensive rebounding numbers are terrific. They don't really have, the Pacers don't really have a guy you can match up with Valanciunas. You know, watching that last game, it's, you know, first of all, way too much yellow in Indiana. I couldn't concentrate on the TV. Too much yellow. But they're not playing like they have confidence. Like, they can't make a shot. They didn't look.
Well,
like,
the Pacers are not a good team. No, like, let's get down to brass tacks here. They just barely made the playoffs. The Raptors dominated them during the regular season. They beat them without DeRozan and Lowry late in the season. I mean, this is what it should look like. Mm-hmm. Like, game three is what we envisioned this series looking like. That's why game one was such a shock.
And I think, too, for the Raps, the fact that Damari Carroll, this guy they brought in the offseason specifically, you know, to lock it down on D, to see him go up and shut down George the way he did, you know, you start to see, okay, our plan is unfolding and these pieces are here. So, you know, I think when you start to see things coming together the way you envisioned, it's all the more encouraging.
And it looks like Carroll's knee is not nearly as big an issue as it was.
Yeah, played 35 minutes in game
exactly.
three.
And he had been typically been playing around 20 minutes or so. So the fact that he was able to go out there for the bulk of the game and you know, play his strong defense, you know, also put up 17 points.
Right. I mean, that's something we have rarely seen during the season with this Raptors team. 21 and 21 from Lowry and DeRozan, and then you throw in the 17 from Damari Carroll and the outstanding defense in 35 minutes. Like, that's best case scenario for this Raptors team.
You know, absolutely. And maybe it was as simple as just getting over the, you know, it was what, 7 or 8 playoff games in a row that they had lost dating back to a couple seasons ago.
Yeah.
And maybe they just had to get that one win. And it's like, okay, guys, we can actually win a playoff game. We are actually a better team than Indiana. So let's just go do this. And then, you know, if they make it to the second round, then the kind of the pressure's off.
Like, the Raptor team that starts game one of round two is so different than the Raptor team that starts game one of round one, right? Yeah. I mean,
it's pretty crazy to talk about a team that finished with 56 wins during the regular season and second in the Eastern Conference playing with house money after just one series win, but they will be.
Yeah.
It's hard to argue otherwise, and you could almost see, and I know it's, as Toronto people that follow Toronto sports, you don't want to be too rosy about it because the rug can be pulled out from under you at any second, but it does seem like a team that if they are able to maybe wrap this series up in 5 games against the Pacers could be dealing with a whole lot of confidence, playing with house money, understanding that at least stage one of the process and the number one goal was complete, that you could see them put in a nice performance against the Miami Heat, a team that they've played pretty tightly all season long. And if they end up against the Cavaliers in an Eastern Conference final, are the Cavs taking them lightly? Probably not, considering the way the regular season has gone. Are we still also talking about this team, yes, in regards to this postseason, but in the offseason as well? Is this still a referendum on DeMar DeRozan and his, I don't want to say ability to get a max contract, because he's going to get a max contract somewhere, whether it's in Toronto or somewhere else. Like, that's already been decided. So it's obviously not a referendum on that. But is it a referendum on him and Masai Ujiri's willingness to hitch his wagon to him going forward for the foreseeable future?
We'll wait to see how this first round plays out, because if they end up collapsing and getting eliminated in the first round again, that changes the offseason just incredibly. Like, and it also, if you're DeMar DeRozan, maybe you don't want to stick around with this team. Maybe you've seen enough of this core group. It's like, guys, we're a great regular season team. We can't do it in the playoffs. I want to go somewhere like and be the star for the Lakers that I grew up cheering for. I'm going to get a max contract. a max deal wherever I go, because that's the landscape of the league right now. So I think there's going to be two things. It's going to be how this first round plays out, how the Raptors, the rest of their postseason unfolds, and it's going to come down to whether DeMar DeRozan wants to be the star on a team or he wants to be one of the stars on a team.
And I think there's also a secondary aspect to this when we're talking about the free agent market for the Raptors. Hey, if they're still painted as that postseason choking team, not to say that, I mean, Kevin Durant, I don't know, I think that's the long shot of long shots, but if we're talking about a second-tier free agent and you have options, are you going to want to go to the team with the tortured franchise history when it comes to the postseason? Maybe an impact there as well.
Yeah, I think if the Raps lose in round one, anything's on the table in terms of changes and next steps.
Oh yeah,
for the franchise.
People are getting fired.
Absolutely,
you know, players aren't going to want to come. Why would you want to come here unless you're, you know, hey, Drake has a lot of pull, I guess. But you know, there's perks to playing in a market like Toronto. The same way there's perks to, you know, if you're a Jays, if you're on the member, if you're a Toronto Blue Jay, you one team in the country. It's an interesting thing, but if you're not into that, you want to go to a team that's going to win. And if you don't want to go to a team that's known for choking in the playoffs.
So then let's go the other way and say, let's say they make the East final, lose to Cleveland in a respectable six games. And essentially, for lack of a better way of putting it, everything works. Now, if you're a free agent out there, you're looking at Toronto and you're saying, well, if I am in the West, I have to go through all these teams,
right,
including Golden State and San Antonio, to get to the final. If I join the Raps and make them, you know, 2 inches better, now you're looking at Cleveland going, well, they still have LeBron, but there's some weird stuff going on there. And I think we can all acknowledge it doesn't just quite fit.
And
who knows?
And he's not 22 either.
Yeah, exactly. The crazy scenario is he leaves again because things are, you know, not really working out there. Or, you know, Father Time starts to chip away at LeBron. And you are suddenly looking at the Raptors going, man, this might actually be my best ticket to get to the final, at least in the next 3 to 4 years.
And the Raptors, they're a relatively young team too. Like, it's not like they have a 1 or 2 year window to get this done. And then the guys are going to leave and they're going to be too old. Like they have guys in their prime and young guys in their early to mid 20s. Like, they have a lot to build. So if they do have some success this year in the postseason, it's going to be a sign that, yeah, if you're a free agent, I can be that sixth man, or I can help this team get over the edge. And it won't just be for 1 or 2 years. You know, there's the core of the Raptors team. There's no real like veterans that are the key pieces to this team. They're all relatively young.
Yeah, it's a real rosy scenario. Boy, it's a lot of positivity here. I like it. Feels good.
Yeah.
On a weekend.
And then when they lose game four and
right,
go down 3-2, then it all changes.
There's actually some positivity in San Jose when it comes to playoff hockey for the first time in a while. The playoff demons erased as they are through to the second round with a victory over the Los Angeles Kings. We'll talk a little Stanley Cup playoffs coming up next and whether the Washington Capitals should be perhaps quivering in their boots a little bit. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Annis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnson on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it!
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Annis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnson. The first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs rolling right along. We have some teams punching their tickets to the second round. Some more relieved than others, to be sure. In this postseason, there's, I'd say, at least three teams with real tortured playoff histories. One is the St. Louis Blues, who we'll get to in just a second. The other is the Washington Capitals, who we'll also get to in just a second. And the third has to be the San Jose Sharks, who are the first of the three to punch their ticket into the second round, and they did it. I mean, if you were going to get some sort of catharsis from a first-round win, it would be the way the Sharks did it, beating their old nemesis, their California rivals, the Los Angeles Kings. They win Game 5, 6-3. There's no tension of a Game 6, and certainly if this thing got to a Game 7, there'd be real, real questions about this Sharks team. I mean, is this team as good as some of the previous teams that have had playoff failures? I'm not sure, but certainly that's a pretty good sign, Ryan, when you're talking about this Sharks team who, you know, was not the most consistent team start to finish in what we thought was not a great Pacific Division, and ended up picking up steam late in the season. But that's not exactly you know, a lightweight they knock off in the first round.
No, absolutely not. And you're right. I mean, if you're ever going to vanquish a ghost, it's by, you know, not only beating your state rival, but the team that came back to dig out of an 0-3 hole in 2014. Like, I feel like the Sharks have been this disappointing team for so long. It's almost like we're past that. Like, in 2010, it was like, oh, here we go with the Sharks. And now, I don't know, like, it's been so long that it's almost like they've made it through to a different narrative without ever actually, like, conquering their ghosts and winning the Stanley Cup. It's just been like,
we're tired of the narrative.
We're so sick of it. But man, you look at that team, and I was writing this after they went up 3-1. You know, in a not so different universe, it's easy to imagine talking about a Sharks team with Joe Thornton, Patrick Marleau, Joe Pavelski, Logan Couture, Brent Burns, Mark Edward Vlasic going for their second or third Stanley Cup, right? I mean, there really is a nice core there, and I absolutely think they have a chance to now win a couple more playoff series. I mean, it's just incredible when you think how long. I mean, even going back to, you know, when Daryl Sutter, the coach they beat last night, was coaching this team, it was still the same story where they'd have good finishes, you know, pre-lockout and gag it up in the first or second round, and then, you know, all through the Joe Thornton era. But yeah, I would say there's kind of no easier team to pull for right now than San Jose, and probably no easier guy to root for than Joe Thornton. I mean, he had such a great last two-thirds to the season. I mean, since December on, he was basically scoring at the same clip as the best guys in the league. You know, you look at the team, did kind of everything it could to alienate him after, you know, yet another playoff disappointment a couple of years ago, stripped him of the C, and he basically said, no, I got a no trade, and I think I'll stick around this sunny California place. And you have to think the Sharks are glad that he never capitulated to their demands or their hopes that he would be willing to be traded. I think, especially if, and I know we'll get there, especially if Chicago goes out in the first round, I don't know that you look at a team. Well, there is no team that I look at in the West and say, well, San Jose couldn't beat that club. I mean, it's close, and whatever four teams are left, assuming one of them isn't Minnesota, I think you could pull any team could have their number pulled. But I mean, the Sharks, probably very similar to the Raptors, right? I mean, it's now going to be a team that's feeling pretty good about itself when it starts round two.
Early in the series, Drew Doughty made some comments. He just kind of alluding to the fact that the Sharks had blown leads against the Kings in years past. And you could, you know, you could make a montage of the Sharks, the players and coaches. They all had this exact same answer as, well, it's a different team. Well, we've got about 10 new players on this team. And it sounded very cliche and everything, but to a certain extent, it isn't the same San Jose Sharks team that has...
New coach. New goalie.
Like, the core of the team, like the big stars on the team, are the same stars. So I think people just view them as the same old Sharks. But in years past, like, they've been President's Trophy winners. They've won their division, and that's when they would, you know, they might win a couple series, but they never made it to a Stanley Cup. And this year, the expectations, like, who had a lot of people had the Kings going to the Stanley Cup,
oh,
or a lot of people had the Blackhawks going to the Stanley Cup. But And even they were, the Sharks were 5-5 in the last 10 games of the regular season. Like they didn't, you know, it's not like they are surging like tremendously impressively at the end of the regular season. They just kind of made the playoffs and the expectations were so low. So I think some people are surprised that they're having success. But if you look at their team, and Joe Thornton's getting a lot of credit, as he should, but their goaltending is a lot better than people give it credit for. Like Martin Jones is not a star name. He's not a big name, but he's a quality goaltender. And you know, just in case, they picked up James Reimer as insurance. But this is a pretty deep team. Like they've got a good blue line. If you compare their blue line to the Kings' blue line, it's more complete.
Yeah,
like they don't have a Drew Doughty, but Brent Burns has 8 points in 5 games.
Well, yeah, he's crowding 30 goals on the regular season. Clearly, he's a weapon back there.
Yeah, and for the Kings, they outside of Doughty and Muzzin, their blue line's really not impressive. Well, yeah,
you got guys playing 10 minutes a night in that series.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so and just even the supporting cast around Thornton and Joe Pavelski, to me, he's been one of the most underrated, underappreciated stars in this league for the last, you know, he's a perennial 30 goal scorer, 40 goal scorer. He's incredible. He's got 5 goals in 5 games in the first round. And guys like Joel Ward, guys like Eunice Donskoy.
Oh yeah, new candidate for greatest handle in the league.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's the Artemi Panarin of the Sharks, as they all say. No one says that. But it, you know, they have a supporting cast, Roman Polak on the blue line, you know, a acquisition late in this regular season, and they're all producing. They do have a deep roster, and I think based on the history, based on their past follies, people didn't give this roster enough credit. And add to the fact that, yeah, they're going up against the Kings that they've struggled against.
But now the Kings come off a season in which they missed the playoffs. They win one postseason game. Nobody's saying that the Kings dynasty is over, are they? Although they, you know, there's some guys getting a little longer in the tooth there.
That's true. I mean, with Kopitar and Doughty and a goalie like Jonathan Quick, you have all the building blocks to still be a great team. But Milan Lucic probably is leaving in the offseason. Also, a little secondary storyline to this series is the fact that it was, in all likelihood, Vincent LeCavalier's last game in the NHL. So shout out to Vinny.
Mm-hmm.
Good player.
Unless he really pulls a little rope-a-dope on the Kings, because apparently they had a handshake agreement that he would retire at the end of this season.
Yeah.
So mention the other teams with some tortured playoff histories. One of them won the President's Trophy going away. The Washington Capitals had that thing locked up for what seemed like forever, the end of the season. We're not playing meaningful games. And it looked like, hey, you know what? All good. We're going to continue this into the postseason against a very mediocre Flyers team. They were up 3-0. Okay, so they lose game 4. It's not a sweep. Okay, game 5, they outshoot the Flyers by about a trillion. As we're talking about, you know, 10 shots on goal on a goalie for the Philadelphia Flyers. But that was enough as they beat the Capitals 2-0 in game 5. Michael Neuvirth, 44 save shutout, and now we're talking about a game 6 for this Capitals team. I'm not saying that there's question marks about who's the better team in this series, but do you, like, you'd only have to be human to look around, if you're on that team, look around the room and say, what's going on here? Like, this can't be happening, can it?
Short answer, right. This can't be happening. They have outclassed Philly by such a large degree, and really look like the way they pulled away in game 3 there, where things got a little ugly and you know, Ed Snyder commemorative bracelets are getting chucked on the ice. Yeah, it's a little hard to believe we're at this point, because I certainly thought, well, you get a team that's down 3-0, you give them game 4 at home, but
sure,
then the idea is you come back to your building and knock them out, and Washington sure did its best to do that because of the aforementioned discrepancy in shots. But
this is how they lose heartbreaking series in the postseason, right? Like, they get shut down by hot goalies, Yaroslav
sure.
Black and Michael Neuvirth.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, the Washington is so good, and they have no weaknesses that I cannot come off my position that they're going to win the East and that, you know, they could beat. No one would bat an eye if they beat Philly 5-1 in game six, right? Right in Philly's own building. But yeah, I mean, it's not ideal. And that's the, as I mentioned in the first block, I mean, that's the fun thing about sports and sports series is just how, you know, things are tipping one way and you think that, you know, it's all said and done how things are going to occur. And then there's just a little drip. Oh, you win game four at home. Oh, boom, you win game five. And now all of a sudden, if you're Philly, you got to win one game in your building to put Washington in a position where it's going, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. We're playing game seven at home in this series. Are you kidding me? We should have had our feet up for the past 3 days. So, yeah, I mean, I like I said, I'm not going to come off my position that Washington is the class of the East and they're such a good team, but I think I'll be tuning in for game six just to see how it goes.
The only reason to be extremely nervous if you were a Caps fan is if Braden Holtby got hurt. I think just the fact that they're outplaying, outshooting the Flyers so much, you can't
stay the course.
Yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. Eventually you're going to get a bounce. Like, it's going to happen. Michael Neuwirth is not going to, you know, win the Conn Smythe Trophy.
No, right? But he's only got to win two games to screw Washington's whole season.
It's true. It's like, tough.
Those shot on goal numbers are ridiculous. 44-11.
It's an anomaly. Like, that. How often do you get outshot that severely and win a game? Like, that never
happens. Flyers, six shots in the first period, which was their most they had in any period. Two in the second and three in the third. One of them was on an open net.
Yeah, empty net.
That is ridiculous.
It's efficient. It's efficiency.
So, seems like an unsustainable shooting percentage. All right, let's go to the third team that has a tortured playoff history. They, too, are looking in the mirror a little bit right now as the Chicago Blackhawks took Game 5 in St. Louis in double overtime. Patrick Kane with the winner as the Blues had a chance to wrap this thing up on home ice. Now, not so much. And it's the defending champs. It's not, I feel like it's a little different scenario with the Blues, because, yeah, I mean, 3-1. It's, I guess, 3-1. At a 3-1 series lead, the expectation levels do change. But we're also talking about the defending Stanley Cup champions, and we're talking about the NHL's leading scorer in Patrick Kane. And I guess we figured this series would be a dogfight and a good series. It has been.
Yeah, no one thought this was going to end in five games either way, and I'll stand by St. Louis. I think I had them in six, and I'll stick with that. They really are a version of the Kings, but now they've got these two guys who can really finish. I mean, Tarasenko, extremely, extremely good around the net. I mean, he's obviously in the upper elite category. He's got 13 goals and 18 playoff games, but also Jaden Schwartz, who missed a bunch of the year with an injured ankle. And they just provide St. Louis with that punch that even though those guys have been on the team for a couple years, I mean, I think they're now contributing at a level they've never reached previously. Brian Allen's largely been very good for them in goal, and they're a big, strong team. I just think, you know, Chicago obviously faltered down the stretch, and more so than any team, even the Kings, you're not going to count Chicago out. I mean, they're so talented, and when they get flying, man, they're tough to stop. But I think St. Louis is going to find a way to do what San Jose did and vanquish the ghost of that's haunted them. I mean, actually, St. Louis has run into both LA and Chicago in previous years, but I still like where the Blues are. That's a tough, tough one to lose at home in overtime, game five. But I think they'll go into Chicago, lay it all on the line there, knowing worst case scenario, we're still coming back for game seven in our building.
Mm-hmm. It is really interesting, the parallels between this series and the Kings Sharks and just the history between the four teams there. Two seasons ago in the playoffs, the Blues were up 2-0 on the Blackhawks, and then the Blackhawks won four straight. And really, until St. Louis wins a series against the Blackhawks, that's going to be there. That stat's going to be there. If I'm Ken Hitchcock, I'm meeting with my players before the next game, and I'm saying, hey, guys, look at what San Jose just did. They just went out and played. They've been the better team this series. The Blues have. The Sharks were the better team in the Kings series. And they just went out and they put it behind them. They just went out and won another game.
And blew after blowing a 3-0 lead, too.
Exactly. You know, the Sharks proved that they can overcome adversity within a single game and within a series. And looking at recent history, if I'm Ken Hitchcock, I'm going to my players and going, guys, use the San Jose Sharks as motivation. Like, look at this other team. They're in the exact same position we've been in. Let's just get over this hurdle. Let's just not have to deal with this. You don't want to have to be talking about this in the off season to all the beat reporters that are going to ask you every day about it. You just focus. You've been the better team this series. Let's get this one done. I think that's what Ken Hitchcock, it would be a smart play for him to point out what the Sharks just did, because there's so many parallels between these two teams.
It's Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnston. So we mentioned there's, I guess, seven teams in the West that can win it all, because I think most people are writing off the Minnesota Wild and maybe the Stars as well, with their inability to stop pucks from ending up in the back of their net. But yeah, it's a little more wide open in the West.
The first and the last seed. Yeah. We can't win the Stanley Cup.
Right. In the East, who can make the Cup Finals? Well, I would hope it would be the team that won the President's Trophy. The Penguins were hotter than everybody down the stretch and continued to play that way in their first round series, on the verge of eliminating the New York Rangers. And then you got the defending Eastern Conference champion, Tampa Bay Lightning. I know no Steven Stamkos, no Anton Strahlman, but boy, they have kind of not missed a beat, and they are through to the second round, knocking off the Detroit Red Wings. Are we starting to buy into the Lightning as maybe that third team in the Eastern Conference that is, you know, in that upper echelon of teams joining Pittsburgh and Washington?
I'm not just yet. I think and a lot of it has to do with the fact that they play in the Atlantic, and the Atlantic division is just, it's just not as good. It's clearly the weaker division in the East. And I mean, if Ben Bishop is playing lights out, that's a different story. But you can say that with any team if a goalie goes on a hot streak.
But he's been good.
He has been good, and they need him to be good. But maybe it's just my gut. I wouldn't be surprised if they make it to the East final.
Well, they have the easier draw, right?
Exactly. That's
the thing. Because the Penguins are going to meet the Capitals.
You're looking at that Pittsburgh-Washington series as chances are that's the team that gets through
exactly
to the Cup final.
Yeah, and the Penguins, I picked the Penguins to win the Stanley Cup because I just think whoever emerges from that division, you know, if Washington can beat the Flyers, and I really hope that happens. I have a bet with a friend that if the Flyers win, I have to eat orange food, only orange food, for 1 week. So
you can't just like dye some food, like dye a steak, like get some food coloring and just dye it orange?
Yeah, just crush up some Cheetos, put it on everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could do that. But whoever comes out of that division is clearly the stronger team, you know. I just can't see any team, if the Panthers win, if the Islanders win, I can't see.
It's tough to see one of those teams.
It's tough. It's
maybe
just
Tampa.
They do have
buy
a history.
Them as,
yeah, I mean, and they've had postseason success.
And you know what? They've done it without Stamkos. I mean, the 2 years ago, they made the playoffs. The year Stamkos broke his leg, you know, they didn't go anywhere, actually, when he came back. But, you know, this team has clearly seen its share of adversity. Ben Bishop got hurt that year.
That's right.
They've been through the ringer. The Marty St. Louis trade.
You mentioned Tarasenko, how he's such a great playoff performer. A guy like Kucherov, Tyler Johnson, they come to play in the postseason.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's fun to watch. And
I would almost say Strowman's the bigger loss than Stamkos to some degree, because they feel like Tampa can score, but losing Strowman on that blue line really hurts.
Yeah, I was just about to say, one of the storylines you didn't really hear of during the Red Wings Lightning series is the absence of Steven Stamkos. It really didn't play into it at all.
Sort of helps when that guy who was demanding a trade a few months ago is going out and putting up three assists in one game and looking like the dynamic offensive force that he was projected to be when drafted third overall. Yeah,
he's certainly upping his trade value.
Yeah.
That's what Steve Yzerman must be thinking.
Well, or he's the guy.
Or I can let Stamkos go.
Yes, which seems like probably the more likely scenario and maybe not entirely in his control, but something that, that might very well happen this postseason. Before we move on, we should maybe pour one out for Pavel Datsyuk, whose
Magic
NHL
man.
Career is likely done, which, I mean, it was not his intent, but I guess maybe screws over the Red Wings cap situation. How do they maneuver that one?
I think it's probably an easy contract to trade if you just make a deal with a team that needs to get to the cap floor, and you know you're not going to be giving up much to, and the Red Wings shouldn't expect much if they're just trading a salary cap.
Yeah, the
number.
Red Wings will have to sweeten the pot for someone. He will be suspended for not honoring the last year of his contract, so there won't be any money that the team actual money that
yeah,
will.
It's just the cap hit.
And
I've maintained throughout this whole season, I really think that the Red Wings are going to go hard after Stamkos.
Yeah, they've been sort of the dark horse.
Yeah, I've got a feeling that, and it would be a good fit there for both sides of it. That's just my gut feeling. But in order to do that, they would likely have to move Datsyuk's cap hit.
It's an interesting power ranking to do. If Steven Stamkos doesn't play next year for the Toronto Maple Leafs or the Tampa Bay Lightning, who are your top three candidates? And I think Detroit consistently tops that list.
Yeah.
Eric Engels wrote about the Canadiens being in on that Steven Stamkos
They would be the natural fit, though, based on what the team needs, how desperately it needs it, and for the player to look at it and go, okay, well, they got the all-world goalie. Mm-hmm. They got the all-world defenseman.
Yeah.
They've got
a 30-goal scorer.
They got a 30-goal scorer in Pacioretty and an emerging 30-goal scorer. Well, I actually hit 30 in Galchenyuk. They need me. if I go there, actually, there's something maybe cooking.
Playing on a line with Pacioretty, he's friends with Subban. It would be him. Very similar market to Toronto.
Yeah, if you strip away the hometown aspect of the Leafs, there's obviously no reason to necessarily come here. But
he's a Markham guy, and if he does have the choice, Maple Leafs, Montreal Canadiens, it would be hard to see him maybe. I don't know.
Subban's a Toronto guy. I know it's a different situation.
He didn't have a choice.
He didn't have a choice, but I'm saying he could do the sell job, maybe.
He should turn heel. He should sign with the Habs. It would be great.
Sportsnet, I'm sure he wouldn't mind me talking out of school like this, but Sportsnet.ca's Gary Mello, who is a pretty passionate backer of his teams and of his town, was like, I think there was talk before the Canadiens completely stunk that, like, well, maybe they'd go for Stamkos at the trade deadline. He's like, oh, if he even played for Montreal, I wouldn't want him in Toronto. You know,
Tainted commodity. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's tainted commodity.
I don't know if I'd go about it that way.
It'd be an interesting offseason.
July 1st is going to be ridiculous, especially around these parts. All right, back to the playoffs for just a second. And yeah, it's been spectacular. And the games, Friday night was just a smorgasbord of Stanley Cup playoff action, overtime, and elimination games. It was a whole lot of fun. The playoffs have also been fun if you like lengthy replay reviews.
Oh, goodness.
About offsides that take place 30 to 40 seconds before the goal is actually scored. We've seen this all season long. We've seen the reviews with goaltender interference, which is a little more, it's not as black and white when you're talking about goalie interference. I've been a longtime proponent of logic and getting things right. I like that. If we have the ability to do that, let's get things right. But there is something not right about an offside taking place in almost an entirely different stage of the game to when a goal is scored and the goal being erased from memory because of this fraction of an inch offside. And Jeff Merrick, I know, has been going through, and his followers have been going through every single significant goal ever scored in the history of the NHL and the Stanley Cup playoffs and finding what's been offside.
New York Islanders dynasty doesn't start with the Bob Nystrom overtime. I mean, that was like 2 feet offside.
Oh, yeah. How do we feel about this?
It is when I watch a lot of NFL, And every time there's a review of, was this a catch? Did he complete the process of the catch? It could be the middle of a great game, and it just takes, it takes me out of it. And it's doing the same thing for the fan. If there was, maybe if there was a time limit on these reviews, like, hey, if we don't have, if we cannot find sufficient evidence within 90 seconds or 2 minutes, let's just go with whatever was called on the ice. It is tough with offside, with the goalie interference. It, a lot of the time it's subjective, so that's different. Offside should be a black and white issue.
And it has, it sort of is, but like there's, it's been like, so close when, some of these when calls.
You know, some people, I think there just needs to be clarification in the off season at the next GM meetings. It's like, what constitutes offside? If a player's skate is off the ice, but it's still, you know, crossing the invisible, you know, if you were to raise the blue line up vertically in the air, if his foot's still on the right side of it, it's just not on the ice. Is that onside or offside? I think they need to just clarify the rules. So maybe,
well, I mean, it is clear that that is, I mean, the way it exists, that is offside.
But some people think that it's like the plane of the blue line.
Right.
If you're, and you know, if you have control of the puck or not, there's all these little things. But in terms of reviews and nitpicking and things like that in general, like, where does it stop? Because on a lot of whistles, a half a second will click off the top, the scoreboard after a play, and that might happen a bunch of times throughout the game. So do we go back and review and then add a bunch of seconds into the at the end of the third period or something? Because technically that would be the right thing to do if you want it by the book, by the letter. Well, there was 4.7 seconds that ticked off during this period, so let's add it on to the back, and it could potentially come into play very late.
I don't think
late
anybody's talking about that.
But it's just, it's these little...
Sounds like Office Space, where they're taking like fractions of a cent and then putting it in a bank account, yeah, making millions.
But it's just, it's little things like that. When a play that's going that quickly is offside by 8 millimeters, and it's not even 100% conclusive because of certain camera angles and everything, and you're wasting 6 minutes and you're taking away from the flow of the game, the players don't like it, the coaches don't like it, the fans can't stand
it. I just don't think
it.
You can start the process of, we're going to try and get this right in the 90 seconds and go, you know what, we don't care. It's taking too long. Like, it is a very binary thing. You're either all in on... Yep. You know, getting, parsing it down to the, you know, fine minutia and saying, okay, I guess it wasn't. Or you're saying these plays, calling them back, are counter to the spirit of the rule. So let them play. And I don't think you can go, the toothpaste isn't going back in the tube.
I've got a solution though. Just allow these offside reviews on rush goals. Like if a goal is short,
that's
immediately
is a distinction.
Just, because you enter the zone,
the actual goal, if it impacts the play, yeah, directly.
Right, like if the
second the other team touches the puck, or
I don't even think you need that, because I mean you can carry the puck like into the corner and, you know, set up and stop. I think it's
45 seconds later.
It's almost like, you know, the momentum. As soon as the momentum is no longer forward moving, like that's a new play. I think is simple enough. I think people would be happy with that.
I don't mind that.
It
would.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there you go.
You
deserve a raise, man.
Thank you. Oh, you're not the first to say that. All right, coming up next, Conor McGregor is a big personality, and he put it all on the line, seemingly, to try and up the ante financially with the UFC. Did it work? Will it work? We'll discuss. Plus, Tiger Woods might be returning sooner than we all thought. That's coming up next. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnston on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine. Here's Christina Rutherford.
She quotes Mike Babcock in interviews. She answers with a straight face yes if you ask whether she's going to the Olympics to win gold. She owns a record not even Tiger or Rory or women's world number one Lydia Ko touch. And she won her first title on the LPGA Tour at age 17. Brooke Henderson is the 18-year-old golfer from Smiths Falls, Ontario. She's ranked 7th in the world and climbing. We spent a day in Brooke's hometown with her. Even played a couple holes at her local club.
Once I was like 8 or 9 years old, I absolutely loved the game. And I just played all the time. And no matter what the weather conditions were like, I just loved to be out there. And really, even now, I don't want to be anywhere else except for on the golf course.
Sorry for the wind. We were on the course. Smiths Falls has known all about Henderson for a while. Now that she's on the LPGA Tour, She's old enough to prove herself on stages where the rest of the world pays attention.
That story and more can be found in the latest issue of Sportsnet magazine on newsstands now. And available on texture by next issue or by downloading the Sportsnet magazine app for Apple, Android, and Windows tablets and phones.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Annis alongside Ryan Dixon and Mike Johnston. You can follow Mike Johnston on Twitter at MikeyJMMA because he likes his MMA. So we're going to throw him a bone here in the last segment. Because sometimes UFC MMA story makes it right into the mainstream. And certainly Conor McGregor as a dude has done that. And this faux retirement thing that people kind of understood was a faux retirement thing when it first happened on Twitter, was retweeted, you know, like 200,000 times. So, Mike, this, it appears as though it was a power play. These generally do not work out in the UFC because Dana White is still able to wield the hammer. What's the latest on this thing now?
So it's not so much about he wants more money for his fight. A lot of people thought that's what it was at first. But it's more that he's just kind of imposing his star power on the UFC. It's like a power play. Mm-hmm. Like they're both, it's these two extremely stubborn sides, the UFC and Conor McGregor. And they're just butting heads right now. And they've done that in the past, actually. Conor McGregor and the UFC have butted heads in contract negotiations in the past. They've reworked Conor's deals. The bigger star he became, they would rework his deals. And Conor McGregor's done a lot for the UFC. He does more press than anybody. He is the biggest draw. I didn't even realize until this week truly what a big global superstar he was. I knew he was the top draw in the UFC, even with Ronda Rousey. He draws more fans to the sport. He gets more pay-per-view buys.
He's on TMZ all the time.
Exactly. You know, he's a great fighter. He's a great talker. He's a great spender of cash.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fine. That's just kind of who he is.
Which is, like, it's interesting to hear him explain why he likes to spend his cash so that he stays hungry, so that he needs to earn more of it.
That's
to
amazing.
Maintain yeah, exactly. that lifestyle.
But it's, you know, his tweet, within 24 hours of him sending that tweet, it had north of 156,000 retweets, and now it's up close to 200,000. That's more than Kobe Bryant's retirement speech, tweet, sorry, from last year. The only tweet from an athlete this year that has more retweets currently is Marshawn Lynch's peace sign and a photo of his cleats hanging up. That's mm-hmm. like, I'm retired, and really maybe the coolest tweet ever in sports.
Yeah.
That's at like 213,000, but the impact this guy has on pop culture, I didn't even realize it. Mm-hmm. I really didn't realize what a true superstar he is until this week. And what's interesting is there are a bunch of contributing factors. He says he's not paid to promote the fight. And it's expected of UFC fighters, especially those at the top headlining a pay-per-view card, that you have to attend press conferences. There are set press conferences that you are expected to be there. I don't know if it's written directly into the contract, so I don't know if technically he's in breach of contract or he's just doing something that the UFC frowns upon. But there's that, and also recently a storyline was he witnessed the death of a fighter at
a local...
Well,
that's what added a little credence to it, and you thought, oh, okay, maybe he is actually calling it quits.
Yeah, well, I think it's more he just doesn't want to do a lot of press right now. He was deeply affected by a fighter who lost to one of Conor McGregor's teammates and succumbed days later to injuries sustained in the fight at a local promotion in Ireland. So that really did affect Conor McGregor, but that's not why he's not coming over. He just didn't want to interrupt his current training camp. The fight's months away, but he's obsessed with the idea that he lost. He needs to redeem himself. His loss to Nate Diaz was surprising to a lot of people, and it was surprising to him. And he even admitted when he released a statement 2 days after his initial tweet saying, I was distracted. Like, I was distracted. I wasn't myself in that fight. And he doesn't want to do that again. He wants to just train. And ironically, and he makes a, it's hard to, you can see where the UFC is coming from. Hey, you have to be at the press conference. You're headlining the card. You can also see where Conor McGregor is coming from, because the tweet, the reason the UFC wants Conor McGregor in Las Vegas this weekend is because they're doing, they're spending $10 million on this epic commercial and promotion with all the fighters on the UFC 200 card. And they're spending $10 million in production costs. Conor McGregor said in his statement, okay, I just saved you $10 million because all the attention I've just generated for this event, it's going to make you that tenfold. You know, you're going to make a lot more money than you were a week ago before I sent that tweet. So now it's becoming a thing. And yesterday there was Friday, there was a UFC 200 press conference in Las Vegas, and Dana White kind of confirmed, no, we're removing Conor from the card. And ironically, Nate Diaz was there just sitting by himself. And he said, I don't care. Like, he's Nate Diaz, his opponent, is taking Conor McGregor's side, saying, I don't care if this guy's at the press conference. Just show up on fight night. I don't like press conferences either. I've skipped stuff in the past, too. It's funny how both fighters in the main event are kind of giving Dana White and the UFC an ultimatum, like, just put this fight together. We want it.
Do you think it happens? Do you think Conor McGregor's at UFC 200?
I don't know if he's going to be at UFC 200. I think it's going to depend on if John Jones wins the main event of UFC 197, it will set up a rematch with Daniel Cormier. And our Daniel Cormier-John Jones rematch is a high-profile enough fight to headline UFC 200. So if that happens, then Conor McGregor could headline UFC 201, UFC 202, and it'll still be this epic, huge event.
Yeah, but it's not 200.
But it's not 200, and there is this, there's just so much. It's going to come down to if Dana, who's going to break? Is it going to be Dana White? Is it going to be the UFC? Or are they just going to say, all right, well, you're going to fight at 202. We told you you're off the card, and we're going to stick to our guns here. They're just butting heads, and it's going to come down to, you know, the UFC does not like getting bullied.
And who does?
It could just be who's going to break first. If the UFC takes a step back and realizes this is the biggest fight on the biggest card ever, we're just going to eat this one, put him back on the card, make a whole bunch of money. It's going to come down to who breaks first. And I don't see Conor McGregor, unless the UFC agrees, all right, you don't have to do press. You know, it's interesting just to see how much power Conor McGregor has over the UFC, because that's extremely rare.
Yeah.
There's no fighters union. There's nothing like that. Fighters get bullied by the UFC all the time. And Conor McGregor's kind of the first guy to go, no, I'm not going to show up.
Well, and I think most people would argue that, yeah, the guy getting punched in the head for a living should probably have a few rights. Before we go, I want to get to this Tiger Woods thing and a great story on ESPN.com written by Wright Thompson. And now these reports that Tiger could return sooner than we all thought, maybe like the middle of May. Does golf need Tiger Woods? Because it seems like it's at a good place, Ryan, but it's not at the place that it was with Tiger Woods, and I don't know if we should ever expect it to get back there.
It won't. Obviously, we don't ever expect him to get back there. It is crazy that you have these fantastic guys at the top. I mean, Jordan Spieth has been so dominant and almost won the Masters again, and he's doing it in against the backdrop of having Rory McIlroy and Jason Day, two other just really, really, really good golfers. But does it feel the same? No, it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't. And you know what? I honestly wasn't, you know, when Tiger was just killing it, I wasn't someone who tuned in to be like, oh, I hope he wins by 15 shots. I was someone who tuned in to be like, can someone challenge him? Like, I'm kind of getting sick of him winning all the time. And now I would say I would, you know, if I was out and about, not that I wouldn't probably be watching the Sunday of a major anyway, but if I happened to be out and about and I heard, oh, man, you know, Tiger is three shots back and he's looking good on the Sunday of a major, I would run to the TV. It would be such a boon to have Tiger come back. And even just rise up once in a while. You know, get it sounds like he's tried to cut the corners too many times with his health. So, you know, you got to take the ground up approach. It sounds like maybe finally he's doing that. So if he can even get back to a point where from age, I think he's 40 now, 40 to 45, you know, every second summer, even he's in one of the majors. I think that would be just enormous for golf.
Yeah, it'd be really cool to see some of the younger players, your Jordan Spieths, your Jason Days, and your Ricky Fowlers going head-to-head with Tiger. Because we've seen it occasionally, but we have not seen it on the Sunday of a major yet. I think Tiger would need to figure out some mental things, and the short game certainly, and the health is number one. But maybe, according to these reports, we do see him in May. That'll do it for another edition of Sportsnet Magazine Live. For Ryan Dixon, Mike Johnson, I'm Ben Ennis. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.